thank you for coming out. This is Burning Books, Friendly Neighborhood Terrorist Induction Center, apparently. So thanks for coming. We got a really special night tonight. And one other thing I want to mention here is on this corner of this table, there's a bunch of materials, most of them actually relate to tonight. This book in particular, Creating a Movement of Teeth, a Movement with Teeth, excuse me, is all about the George Jackson Brigade, which is what Mark has been involved in and what he's mostly going to be talking about tonight. There's another book, Guerrilla USA, unfortunately we only got one left, also about the brigade, that's more of a narrative. And this book is about, is written, recently came out by Ed Mead, who I'm sure Mark will be talking about, who's a co-defendant, another member of the brigade. It's called Lumpin' and it just came out. And we're trying to bring Ed Mead in the spring, if his health is permitting. So check that out if you get a chance. Also, we got a bunch of cool new stickers, including my personal favorite, All My Heroes Have FBI Files. Must have. So all I got left to say is that it's a real honor to have Mark here tonight. Eliza, my daughter, and I and Mark went out to see Jaleel Muntakim, who's in prison. He's a Panther who's imprisoned at Attica this morning. We spent the morning out there talking with Jaleel. And, you know, just really struck home as I was listening to those two talking that there's all this history that isn't really written about in many books and isn't talked about in school and usually isn't put on the TV. And we don't hear about it, and it's so rich and so significant, and it's the reason why we have these freedoms that, you know, the few that we do still have, because people fought and struggled for them. Mark is a person who's done that. He's been involved in a lot of different ways. He's a Black Panther inside prison, and he's involved in really risking his life and his freedom for the betterment of all of us. So let's just thank Mark and welcome him to Burning Books.
This is part of my world tour and national tour. That picture was just taken in China. I was invited to the University of China in Hong Kong and spoke there at three different colleges, then spoke at various bookshops on the streets. And then they did, the last time I talked, it was at a restaurant. Only about six people were supposed to be there. They just wanted to be introduced to me. It ended up with 48 people at night. They got chairs and benches for I don't know where to come and listen. We had two interpreters doing Cantonese and Mandarin Chinese. And there were the foreigners, Germans and French. A lot of people came. It was really a fantastic adventure there for me. Before I get too far in, I want to explain to you that I suffer from a disability. I'm autistic. And sometimes I don't understand what you're saying, and I don't understand, you may not understand what I'm saying. Sometimes I don't understand what I'm saying, and I'll stop and cut short. It's not the old age thing creeping up. That's mixed in here now with it. It's not just old age. I found out I had autism when I was about 60 years old. That's while I was in prison. Is a doctor who ran some questions by me. He said, "Do you understand what I'm saying all the time?" And I said, "Well, no, not really." And he said, "What about when you talk to the prison officials? Do you understand what they're saying when they're holding meetings and trying to tell you something?" And I said, "No." And he went into depth and he says, "You have autism. You've had it all your life. It's not something that just comes up while you're in prison. And somebody should have caught it earlier. Last week I was at the University of Washington listening to some of the medical students give a talk on the mass incarceration. And one of the things they do in teaching the students is how to go to the source of a problem when you have a patient. And a patient may say, "Well, I have a rash." Well, that's not the real problem. The rash is, where did that rash come from? They ran this story by about, it's kind of a legend, not a legend, but it's just an allegory, I guess you call it, where there's this village, and let's say they're medical students living in this village. I'm just sticking that in. They didn't stick that in, but that's what they're trying to say. And some babies came floating down the river. And so they ran out and they got the babies and brought them in. They got them all in, and they looked, more babies were coming down the river. They ran out and brought them in. And they just kept looking at the river, waiting for more babies. And the instructor said, "Well, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to look at the source. You're supposed to go up that river and find out who's throwing those babies in and why they're throwing them in." In a sense, we look at a lot of people who ended up in situations, say prison. I did probably 210-year sentences as a thief. I never did all that time. I mean, that's what they gave me, 210 years. And nobody looked back and said, well, why is he doing this? What happened? I was raised by my mother. She has 8 children. My father died when I was about 4 years old. And she raised us and kept us all together. And she was our safety net. She worked sometimes 16 hours a day. And it was up to us kids to take care of us. Nowadays, they have this law against latchkey kids. You can't do that nowadays and you'd be violating the law. But there was no law then. And it was a community and our extended family that helped keep my mother going. And who stayed with us all the way until we all graduated from school or ended up in prison, which was me. I'm the one that fell through that net of all the 8 kids. Nobody else did. And nobody, when I started having problems, the first problem I had was at high school, I broke a window. That ended up doing 3 years. It was really an indefinite sentence, but I only did 3 years, starting at age 17. And it was a brutal treatment. I've been in 17 prisons across the United States, and as a maximum security prisoner, the highest security, the highest custody. And I've never been treated as an adult as I was treated as a kid. I won't tell you specific what happened, but I tell you, it was horrific. And to this day, right now, my main struggle is with juveniles and kids who are in detention when they're going in and when they're coming out. Because I want to know who's throwing the babies in the river. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These kids are, some of them are truants, some are products of domestic violence, family abuse, you know, sexual and violent. And they're committed no crime, but they're put in these detention places. The others were like me, you know, they broke a window, stole a car, or whatever. And some of them getting these shootouts, you heard about in the news, maybe actually killed a parent. Nobody cares why. It's just that they did it, and they're going to punish them for it. So that's what I'm doing mostly in my life right now. So I was born, I was raised affluent poor. In other words, I had a place to stay, I had something to eat, and never missed a meal. Mom took care of that. So affluent poor is different than the desperate poor. That book, The Lumpin', is about someone who was desperate, a desperate poor. They had nothing. They tried to raise during the early 40s, tried to raise money on a chicken ranch. The chicken ranch didn't go good. And it was pretty much chickens one day and feathers the next. Finally, they moved from the Mideast into California, always struggling, trying to find some kind of roof. They lived in warehouses. It was him and his 2 sisters to start off with. Their mother was taking care of him, never left him, but was taking care of him. Like I said, that was desperate poor. So when we look at people on some of these kids on the streets, people in the house, we're looking at affluent poor and the desperate poor. And that's one of the main issues. That's one of the issues that brought the Panthers together, is the government wasn't doing anything. So the Panthers decided, let us try to do something. We did free clinics. We did freedom schools. Free breakfast for kids, made sure all the kids in the community had a breakfast before they went to school. We had a 10-point program. It was organized. A lot of the movements now aren't organized, but it was organized with those basic things in mind. And we did pretty good. In Seattle right now, of course, you know, the Panthers are pretty much broken up and gone. But we have a clinic that's called Carolyn Downs Clinic. At one time, it was a free clinic. You didn't charge you anything to get in. Now it's a sliding scale. Carolyn Downs was a Panther. She died of cancer. That's why they gave her the name. There's the one of the Freedom Schools. It carries the name of Tyree Scott. Freedom Schools were started by the Panthers, but to this day, we still have a Freedom School going in Seattle. And in California, in Oakland, there's other things that are still existing that Panthers started. And the thing is, the government would not do things for them, so they had to do it for themselves. And then it came a struggle where they're making the government look bad. And that's where the conflict came up between the government and the first between the government and the Panthers. When I was in prison doing this 210 years, you know, as being a thief, the Panthers were rising. They came up on black and white TV. I saw them there on the pictures of them on the Capitol with their shotguns. And it was legal for citizens to carry guns in California openly at that time. And shortly after that, they made a law. While the Panzer was still in existence, they made a law saying people cannot carry guns openly in public anymore. Well, in a sense, kind of stopped things. Being a felon, whether it's, how can I put it? I wasn't allowed to carry a gun, but in order to be a Panther, this was a militant group, you had to defend yourself, defend your community and what you were doing. There was some of you probably saw the Panther movie recently on public TV. They got it up here for sale if you want to see it, if you missed it. It's something really you should really look at and listen to some of the stories back then. There was one story where the police were on a scene and it was getting desperate, so they racked up their guns, clack it. But then they heard a noise all down the street, clack it, clack it, clack it. And that was the Black Panthers of the community standing up, protecting their community. In Seattle, the way they started a clinic was, first it led the free breakfast program. There's a book by Elmer Dixon someplace around here. And he started a free breakfast program in Seattle. He was stealing food out of the icebox, out of his refrigerator. His mother said, where's all the food going? Him and his brothers, they were just teenagers at the time. And they finally broke down and said, well, we're making breakfast for the kids. And she said, that's cool. And so it started from that point, they started doing a breakfast program. Then later on, they started going to these supermarkets and, you know, food is stamped. After it's stamped, they throw it away. But it's still good to eat. And because if you buy something, you keep it in your refrigerator, it passes that date while it's in your refrigerator, and you still eat it. And so they gave this food to the Panthers to do these free breakfast programs for the kids. Then it came time to do a clinic. They wanted to do a free medical clinic. Now, these are the Panthers. There's not no NGOs or anybody else helping them. And they tried to figure out how to do a free clinic. And they went to this doctor, and this is Elmer Dixon, and he said, how can we do a free clinic? We got a place, but we don't have no medical equipment at all or supplies at all. A doctor worked at the University of Washington. He said, come to the University of Washington at this address, bring a truck and back it up. And backed up, they filled it up with medical supplies, and that was the first free clinic set up in Seattle. When I was in prison, I formed a Panther group inside of prison. And I wanted to do things along the same lines, but I'm in prison. There's no kids to feed. You know, we got our free medical thing going there, but the jobs are lousy. Nobody's learning a skill that they can carry outside. So I want to start a program inside and with the Panthers, and I got to get the help of all the prisoners to do this. And the way I did it is working with some really immigrants. These were Canadian immigrants, by the way. Showed me how to do an underground newspaper using mimeograph paper and gelatin and mirrors. And, you know, it was a little thing where we had to boil some gelatin down, pour it on the mirrors, let it cool, put the mimeograph paper after we typed on it on the gelatin. It absorbed print, peel the paper off, then take blank paper, put it on, smooth it over, and peel it off. And we had an underground newspaper. In the newspaper, we made sure that nobody knew who was putting this thing out, but information we used was recognizable by all the prisoners. Everybody had the same grievances, you know. Nobody was allowed to have long hair, hair on their face, no sideburns. Your hair had to be a quarter of an inch or less, or you went to solitary confinement. And so we had to put a slogan in there, if you care, grow hair. So everybody in the prison started growing hair. That was the beginning of our movement there. And at one point, there was a movie being shown. This was a racial incident where there was 100 rifles by Jim Brown and Raquel Welch, I think it was. And some of the white supremacists says, no, you're not going to show that movie in our auditorium. They said, we'll show it or we're going to lock this joint down. Well, you could lock it down. Just a handful of, you know, of blacks in the prison. And about 17% maybe were black prisoners. Said, okay, we'll lock it down by ourselves, but we ain't coming out till we get to see what we want to see. So the black prisoners locked it down, and the white prisoners said, hey, if they're going to lock it down, we're gonna go with them. You know, whatever they get, we're going to get our grievances done too. The whole prison was locked down. That was probably one of the first nonviolent prison takeovers in the history of U.S. prisons, at least in the state of Washington. So coming from that, we finally got what we call a 50-50 program. The prisoners could run the recreation and educational and industrial, and the state would run the security and the custody. And if, like, it used to be when you got drunk on Pruno, you know, they'd lock you up and give you an infraction. But we got it so, look, they're alcoholics, lock them up, but we're going to sit outside the cell until they sober up, then put them straight back on the population, no infraction. They said, cool. We had things going like that. It was a pretty good move. This is back in about 1969. And it's well documented. They archived all of this stuff in Whitman College, so if anybody ever wants to look at it, I think they still have our little underground newspaper. Nobody seems to find that thing. We call it the bomb, by the way.
This is Defiant Straw Radio, and you're hearing Mark Cook speaking at Burning Books Bookstore in Buffalo, New York, February 18, 2016.
But anyways, as a Panther, I worked that through. We took over the prison. Now the next thing is to set up these jobs. So we asked for a tier where we could have, say, 16 prisoners. And these 16 prisoners would pick the kind of industry they wanted to work in. And so the warden let us do it. He was ordered from Olympia to let us do it. This is probably a longer story than what I'm telling you right now, but we were able to set up a reupholstery training class, these 16 prisoners. It worked out well. Finally, they gave us a shop in Prison Industries. We worked there, and it was the only shop that made a profit in all the prison industries in the state of Washington doing reupholstery. So the next thing we said, well, we want to do this outside of prison. They said, well, it ain't happening. So our thought was this. They had a women's quarter, old women's quarters, dilapidated kind of thing, and they built a brand new one for women in a town called Purdy. And so we asked them, if you give us that women's quarters, we can set up an industry there, you know, where we could work freely and make more money for you. And he said, you're not making any money for us out there. He said, I'll tell you what you're going to do. If you can get enough money to pay for all of the costs of running that thing, he said, we'll do it. And chuckle, 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 right? So we sat down and we got $250,000 grant. If we could find matching funds. We're prisoners, we ain't got nothing to match. And you know, prisons are nothing but institutionalized poverty. People don't have anything in there. They make sure you don't have anything. They shake your cell down, constantly taking things away from you. But we had it was a Ford Foundation, and I like to say that the CIA, which was Correctional Industry Agency, okay. But anyway, we called it the CIA. They gave us the money, and now we need matching funds. So we got this idea from what happened with the Panthers in Seattle. Try and get some equipment. Well, first thing is, they said that building is part of our matching fund, but we needed more than that. So we got carpentry equipment, upholstery equipment, power speeding machines, and, you know, so that was all together. We went to the warden and said, okay, we got it all together. Give it to us. He said, yeah. He said, only if we can screen the people. Us 16 would screen the prisoners coming out, going out into that thing. They allowed us to do that. Okay, so it's set up for a two-year program. I don't know if they got mad at me or what. I was doing 3 50-year terms at a time, being a thief, a robbery, and they decided to get rid of me. The governor came down and told them to get me out of there and get me into a halfway house in Seattle. A couple of days later, I was at that halfway house, and the halfway house didn't know who I was or what I was doing there. I said, well, I'll just go on home. And he said, no, not until we find out what you're doing here. Because I still had a mandatory 15-year sentence to do. So they eventually found out who I was, and so they kept me there. They kept me there a year. While I was there, during that year's time, I founded a group called Convention, capital C-O-N, little stuff after that, you know. It was for convicts. My idea was, I'm going to get judges and prosecutors and victims and ex-prisoners and maybe prisoners in the prisons that come to this thing, guards and wardens, you know, do this thing. I'm in a halfway house, still doing time. But I walked around Seattle the various organizations, and they liked the idea too. They were giving me money for this thing called convention. We're going to hold it about a year later. They're giving me cash. I'm in a halfway house getting these checks coming in, and the halfway house said, okay, we'll go along with this. Nobody's blocking it. And so we did it, did get the money, and also we got the promise from the institution to send us prisoners in handcuffs. Okay, victims came. The dean of law at the University of Washington, he came along with other lawyers. There were judges and prosecutors there. And we ran that thing for about 3 or 4 years. And money-wise, it was always in the black. We never had to beg money. People just giving us money just to come to see this thing. So again, that's a documented program, but it's something I was trying to do and still be a Panther. When I went to Seattle, I finally got out of the halfway house after being in there a year. Anyways, I got out of the halfway house and I looked for the Panthers, and they were gone. They're all down in Oakland being bodyguards for Elaine Brown. I don't know if you remember. Elaine Brown became the chairperson of the Panther Party while Huey Newton was in Cuba? Or? No, he was in jail. Jail or Cuba? I think he was in Cuba. I don't know. Yeah. And so I still wanted to do something. I said, well, we're still got this job thing going. And one of the Canadians that got out, he got kicked out of prison with me. And he helped form that program. We call him the mayor. He's the one who figured out how to get the stuff out of the University of Washington. He came to me and he said, hey, how about starting in the program out here? And we'll get all of the people coming out of halfway houses, people on probation, you know, et cetera. And well, I said, how are we going to do that? They said, they're getting ready to shut down that program inside. I said, why are they going to shut that down? They said, it worked. I said, that's what his way of thinking. And I think he's probably right. So we went down there and told him what we wanted to do. Well, we had to get that grant, though. Had to get grant money again. We did the same thing, wrote them grants. Ex-convicts on the street, we got $250,000. Again, they want matching funds, too. So what are we going to do? We went to the University of Washington once. They will never let us go again. This time, we want more equipment. We're going to do micrographics, landscaping, you know, reupholstery, laying carpets, all of that. So we need equipment for all this, a lot of power equipment. So we made a try. We went to the University of Washington and said, hey, can we see what you got in your warehouses? Because what they had in their warehouses, it's already paid for. They can't sell it again. They could throw it in the dump if they want to, but what they're doing, they're keeping it stored. Every college around here has that right now if you ever want to stop and check it out. And we told them, we need matching funds, we got this cash, we want to put this work program together. They gave us all of that machinery. We called it Pivot. Pivot ran for quite a while. I was interrupted from that with the George Jackson Brigade. There was some white groups in Seattle that wanted to be a little bit more militant than they had been. They got tired of marching around in circles, going down to the courthouse, waving their signs and speaking and going home. So they wanted to get involved with the program 24/7. And so as they didn't know what to do, they didn't have any funding. Now this time, we weren't going to do no grants. They wanted to go underground. These are some of the weather underground people and some Panthers. And there was some, Native Americans. They weren't out of AIM, but they were militant too. They wanted to go with this thing. So we put it together and we did what we call armed propaganda. The armed was specifically bombing, targeting property, not people, as the main thing. Always property, not people. We made one mistake, and that was where we did a bombing at a Safeway. We called in and told them to get everybody out. There's a bomb in there, and they thought hogwash. It was in a bag of dog food. It went off, and two people were hurt. Nobody was killed. Two people were hurt. And we got lambasted by the community, the radical community, even the so-called militant community in Seattle behind that thing. So we did write a letter of apology to the alternative press. Nobody really knew who he was, so we had to get all this stuff done underground. Every time we did a bombing of a place supporting a union strike or the abuse in the prison, like one of the bombings we did, we blew up the Department of Corrections in Olympia. because of some brutality that was going on in Walla Walla, in the prison there. And they fired the warden and some of his associates, corrected things, and it was a lot better. This was armed propaganda. That was back in the days when it was happening all over the United States. It wasn't just there. The other Panthers, I was the only Panther out of the prison that was on the streets, but there were other Panthers working with us underground. And we were lucky. We never told people anything they didn't need to know. We did an escape, broke one of our prisoners loose, one of the captured prisoners loose from our custody. I shot a cop, and I thought he was trying to fast draw me, and I just wounded him. And so I got, eventually 30 years in prison by the feds, two life sentences, and 10 years for the attempted escape, running consecutively, one right after the other. I was in the fed system. I did all of the time there. They wouldn't give me a parole. We went to parole board every 2 years. They turned me down. They had these letters in my file saying never to parole me, coming from police departments, etc. So, like I said, I did all that time, and curious thing, just before I got out of the feds, I got transferred out of there after I did my time, but my last year there, I was a homeless prisoner. In other words, I had no cell. I had a laundry bag, one of these kind of laced or whatever, you know what I'm talking about, and all my property was carried in this bag. I had to walk around the prison with this thing, no place to live. When it came time for a count, I'd go to the hospital, and they'd count us there. There's a whole group of us. And then after they counted us, back out into to the yard on the compound. And they let us hang out at some of the cell blocks. We did have cells there, but we could hang out until it was time to get locked up. When it came time to get locked up, they took us up and put in the hospital. All the beds in the hospital were filled up. We slept on the floor. That would be in homeless in prison. This is a federal penitentiary. That was my last year there. So I finally kicked out of there, sent to the state to do my parole violations, two life sentences, and 10 years. I got partway through my parole violations, and in a sense, the parole board just said, you've done too much time, just kicked me out. Never did life sentences at all. None of the life sentences, none of that stuff for the escape. So, and back on the streets, and that's where I'm at right now, and I'm doing my tours, like in China, any country who wants to call on me, any state. I've gone to Oregon, California. Now I'm back east here talking. And, I'm just a rank and file. I was inside, I was the lieutenant of information. I had to teach the people, the prisoners, what the Panther program was about. But I was really just a rank and file Panther. Loyal to the Panthers all the way. We got a lot of respect out of those guys in Seattle, in Oakland, but I was just rank and file. But I, for some reason, people want to listen to me talk. Maybe it's because I'm one of the survivors, But there's plenty of survivors still in prison. Right. And in a sense, they've done less than I did. I'm technically the worst of the worst. When they talk about prisoners, I'm the worst of the worst. They want to keep us in solitary confinement. Not for infractions, but just to keep us from organizing on the population. I had one infraction in 24 years in prison. That's for walking across a grass lawn. I was supposed to go around it. That's the only infraction I had in all that time. It kind of made them angry. They said they have no political prisoners. The U.S. says no political prisoners in the U.S. In my file, prison file, when you first open it up, there's a document that says, the political statement of the George Jackson Brigade. That's the first thing you see when you open that file up. And I got a glimpse at it, and I asked them, well, what do you got that in there for? That was printed after I was arrested. And they said, well, that's what the government wants. They want this in there. And in a sense, that's just saying, I'm a political prisoner. And there's no other reason. It had nothing to do with the crime. Everything was printed after I was arrested. There's about 200 other political prisoners locked up right now, men and women, who have done more time than most people do for homicides. That's a fact. And they're not letting them out. Ed and I kind of cut them out of their week. It caused a lot of problems in Walla Walla. He is organizing a group called Men Against Sexism down there, and they were stopping the selling of prisoners for sex and abusing them. He did pretty good, but they had to arm themselves. He made shotguns and hand grenades while he's in that prison. People smuggled in firearms, and when they took his cell down once, they couldn't find anything. Went back again, opened his radio up, and there were the hand grenades and the pistols. And so they had decided they got to get rid of Ed out of the Washington State Penitentiary. And they stuck him in with the feds. So he was doing a state sentence at that time. To go with the feds, they said, well, he has to start his fed time, so he's going to run them both concurrently. They didn't intend to do that. So they ran them both concurrently. So he finished his federal sentence. Well, they sent him to the state. The state said, well, your sentence were running concurrently, so you only have to do a couple of years and you're out. So, like I said, he got over. While I was in prison, they transferred me to the state, had a lot of support from the people on the streets. They hooked me up with the Mumia as a defense committee for Freedom Committee for Mumia and Mark Cook. And they did a lot of stuff on the streets. They did street theater, you know, the burning of effigies in the street and stuff like that, and hassling the police, writing to various officials, state officials, and the prison authorities, and they raised a lot of support on the street. In fact, when I got out, they finally did get me out. The state prison said, well, you've done enough time already. In fact, and they admitted, yeah, you're the only person left in of your Jack's Brigade. You're black, all the others were white. They never busted the Native Americans or anybody else, three of us. Well, four of us. One got killed.
This is Defiant Straw Radio, and you're hearing Mark Cook speaking at Burning Books Bookstore in Buffalo, New York, February 18, 2016. Here's a little content warning coming up that Mark talks about Ed Mead's experience with childhood sexual assault. So if that makes you uncomfortable, you may want to skip ahead or turn down the radio for about 3 minutes.
But if you get a chance, if you read Ed's story, he was raped when he was a priest, not a preschooler, but a pre-teenage kid. Some guy had offered him and another kid some comic books if he had, you know, come on up to his place, and when they got up there, they trapped him, wouldn't let him out, and raped them both. The other kid told, and both Ed and him were punished for being abused, you know. Okay, but he went through a lot of things like that. His mother thought she could get a job in Alaska, moved all the kids up there. They were homesteading. They carried their furniture into the woods on their backs, you know. They tried to make log cabins, and it's a real hassle. It's an interesting book. It's a true story. There's a lot of humor in it, along with, you know, their desperate situation. And one of my favorites is, he kind of changed his story for the book, but a long time ago, he told me, he's got one eye. He told me he had a girlfriend, and he wanted to show how tough he was, so he took a gun, and he just whirled that cylinder and put it, and says, bam, and blew his eye out. But, well, you know, it probably hurt, but I mean, but looking back on it, it's kind of funny. He tells another he tells another story to kind of clean it up. It's still funny when you read it in there. I stayed pretty close to Ed. Ed hassled me. Ed came to one of my first conventions, and he called me a bourgeois Negro. You know, you ain't got this thing going. And at these conventions, we had the Weather Underground showing up, AIM showing, Brown Berets. All the real militants were showing up at these conventions, along with these judges and prison officials. But he is a strong Marxist-Leninist. And I didn't speak that language. I was speaking from the Panthers. I was trying to do something for the community, trying to pull people together so we could get things done the government wouldn't do, the state wouldn't do. But that's where I first met him. All the people that ended up in the brigade came from the convention. They heard I was in there. They came and joined. Some that joined, some were just supporting on the perimeter, the periphery, what you call it. But they were very strong, and when I got out, they raised $8,000, put it in my hand when I stepped out that door. They gave me a car, got me a job. The day I got out, got a job and a place to stay. And I was no longer the affluent poor. I was middle class. Except I didn't have American flag. Sorry about that. I was still a Panther. If anybody's got any questions, I'd like you to go ahead and start with you.
Yeah, I think you're about to touch on that at one point, but can you talk about the diversity of the Georgia excavated?
Without disclose, well, let's put it this way. The ones that are documented by the FBI are a lesbian, a white gay, a white straight, a female straight, me, I'm black straight. In fact, you know, I kind of had to abandon one of my kids in order to do this stuff. And that's the only regret I have about anything. He turned in a pretty good kid. I got three stepkids and him. See him to this day.
Can you say anything about what's going on in China? Did you pick up any idea of what's going on there?
Before it hit the news lately, they were building up for a union movement inside of China. They're forming unions. The Chinese had a state union. You know, if you had grievances, just go to your union and they'd set up, you know, meetings later on. But it's taken so long, it takes sometimes years to set those meetings up. So they started doing these wildcat unions all over China. You probably see them in the news now, where they're starting to lock people up behind these unions. This is on the mainland China. I was in Hong Kong. When I got my passport to go to China refused to let me go in. And of course, I wrote a letter and said, "Hey, I'm a Panther. You know, you invited us over there in '71, and we sat and talked with you. And they invited us in Vietnam as Panthers to talk with them." But now they said no. But they have this thing with the Hong Kong has this thing with the U.S. where you don't even need a passport, just a visa. You go to Hong Kong. When I was in at the university in Hong Kong, a professor told me, if you want to get in China, you get your visa here, and we'll take you over there in a couple hours. But the people in Hong Kong kept me so busy and never got a chance to go to China. Just before I left, I got to talk to a political prisoner who came out of one of the prisons in China at the airport. And he wrote a book. I never got that book, but he said he's going to send it to me. Question? Yeah, you.
So of all your organizing, what would you say what you felt was the most effective and why?
Well, mostly is personally, it was a convention. The thing that I invented decided this is something I got to do. Mm-hmm. And the main issue was I wanted prisoners to have the right to vote. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if I ask for hands here, how many of you think if we give prisoners the right to vote, it'll hurt you in any way? Is there anybody here? There's got to be. We're not going to jump on you. I just want to figure out at least one.
No way.
Okay, so you see, now, so they got 2.5 million prisoners inside. If they had the right to vote, don't you think there'd be a third party? Because they're not going to vote for the Democrats or the Republicans. Yeah. Well, maybe they will. I mean, knowing prisoners inside, you know, it goes anyway inside. Yeah. But that was my main issue with convention. I wanted to get everybody together, and I had my workshop. People had other workshops, but my workshop was on the right to vote. And this is a question I always raised. And to me, that was the most positive thing I did myself as a Panther when I got out of prison, was putting that convention together. Knowing that people were going to support it. They were supporting it. They built us a bankroll, you know. We had places to meet. The police were hassling us. They'd go around and take the license plates of everybody who was at these meetings. And finally, the mayor told them to get off our back, stop that stuff. His name was Spellman. Spellman in Seattle backed the Panthers a lot. There were the Red Squads who were going to do a drive-by on the Panther headquarters, and mayor said, not in my city, you're not going to do that. He was a strange mayor. You know, of course, he didn't last that long. Okay, the question again, you said, what was the makeup of the brigade? I gave you the makeup, but there were people who were in the brigade, but they gave us very strong support. I did the jailbreak with four women. One was a black pregnant woman who did the casing inside the prison. She was not a member. There was a First Nation woman, Yakima Indian, She was one of the drivers in a such situation. In order to get cars and steal license plates for these cars, we had other people, a lot of them out of the gay community, who came in to give us help. Nobody got busted. Nobody even opened their mouth about that stuff. And this is not the first time I talked about it, but I rarely talk about people that helped us. And I always give them their code names. I go along with the code names they had. And some of the code names we had, some of them were pretty colorful. Calico, she had a cat. It was a calico cat. So we called her Calico. That was her code name. Bo, a lot of people know Bo out of Oakland, California. She's a very active person to this day. Her name was Belle. She liked Belle Star, so we gave her Belle as a code name. And there's others. Like I say, they're very colorful. If I ever write a book, I'd like to let people know who they were in and the real work they did. Yeah.
What did the judges do at the convention? What did the judges do there?
Charles Smith was the head of the dean of law school in University of Washington. He was our keynote speaker. That was one. The others sat in a workshop. Two of them sat in the victim's workshop, you know. But we had public defenders there, too, as well as people who were supporting the victims. Ah, there's a curiosity. When I got out of prison, I got my job. I was working with the public defenders. They started me off doing mail runs, you know, saving postage to all the courts. I'd deliver stuff and pick stuff up and bring it back. Well, one of the prosecutors who sent me, he got me two life sentences in 10 years. He saw me doing these mail runs. And he called the public defenders. He says, "Does Mark Cook work there?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Could I talk to him?" And he said, "Yeah." So they called me up to the phone. I said, "Yeah, this is Mark." He said, "Well, hey, I'm Dugan, Mike Dugan. You know who I am?" "Yeah." I said, you're the guy who sent me." I used a little flowery language there. "Sends me to the two life sentences." He said, "Yeah, well, would you go to lunch with me?" God. I said, "Yeah." So I did go to lunch with him. That was one of the strange things I had. Yeah. The state's witness who falsified information. Of course, they got $20,000 for this false information. But that was the chief state witness in the federal and state court. Her name was Susanna Weisfield. You probably heard about Kmart and Weisfield. Well, she's heir to that. She owns that right now. Okay, but at that time, she was working as running as a radical on the streets. She helped found one of the radical bookstores in Seattle. Well, I was at the last Democratic caucus, and during the caucus, this woman kept looking at me, and I didn't know who she was. I didn't recognize anybody. And when it was over, she came over to me and she said, "You know who I am?" And I said, "No." She says, "I'm Suzanne." God, all these people around, I could have strangled that woman right there on the spot. There's so many witnesses, I never would have got away with. But she was in a witness protection program. But she came straight up to me and just said who she was. She said, "I'm so sorry." And that was about it.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're hearing Mark Cook speaking at Burning Books Bookstore in Buffalo, New York, February 18, 2016.
I saw that show on public television. In fact, I watched it 3 times. I was a preteen, so I was totally oblivious to what was going on. But it was awe-inspiring, but in the show, they had a map, and they had a list of all the cities where Black Panthers were. They had chapters. Do you know, and how many were there? Do you know how many members there were across the whole country altogether, collectively? Because they never mentioned it in the show. They mostly focused on Oakland.
We had a lot of people who rode along, said they were Panthers. They weren't. There were about 900 Panthers.
Across the country, there were 900.
About 900. And there was...
hardcore.
Huh? Well, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah, hardcore.
Yeah. The largest... We politicized gangs. Bunchy Carter in Los Angeles politicized the Slauson gang. Later became the Crips or whatever. Detroit, Fred Hampton, he politicized the Blackstone Ranges. That was a fantastic and a beautiful experience there when he did that, but you heard what happened to him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, Bunchy Carter got killed too. He got killed on the Berkeley campus, shot in the back. But a lot of people were in there just for the image, you know. They did their afros and wore their leather jackets. when things got hot, they split. Two-thirds of the Panthers were women, which is strange to me, because when you see all these movies and things, you don't see that percentage representing the Panthers. They're the ones that did the free school, the free food, the clinics. They did the work in all of these places. They also carried guns. They were on the streets. They did the, what you call it, the cop watch, if you want to call it that. Followed them with the shotguns and stuff like that. But the only people you hear are the bosses, you know, people who, like me, I was a lieutenant, so I got a little publicity. All of the people in the Central Committee, they got publicity, and you see the people up there that they display in this movie. And of course, there's one, Dave DeHilliard, which, like I say, I'd punch him in the mouth if I had the chance, you know. He did a dirty thing. He copyrighted the Black Panther logo, etc., so nobody is supposed to be able to use it anymore. Yeah, and we talked about that at our last convention. What is this, 40th convention of the Black Panther Party. This year will be the 50th convention of the Black Panther Party. We're gonna, don't know exactly where we're gonna have. It's gonna be, hopefully, someplace down in Oakland. Oakland is cleaned up now. It's not like it used to be. Last time I was down there, it was a little shaky going in there to hold that party. And we was kind of surrounded by the police when we did it. But they acted wisely. Because even though, you know, people were supposed to carry guns openly, you know, you got to be a revolutionary, you got to break the law, simple as that. And they knew we were revolutionary. Yeah, it applies to today. One of the things, when I get the chance, I want to talk about Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and Black Lives Matter.
This is Defiant Straw Radio, and you're hearing Mark Cook speaking at Burning Books Bookstore in Buffalo, New York, February 18, 2016.
Point program. He talked about the black and oppressed communities. If you read those points, he said the black and oppressed communities. He wasn't talking about all that. In Seattle, the drill master for the Black Panther Party was Japanese. His name is Mike Tagawa. Me and him travel a lot together when we do these conventions and things. Marilyn Buck, she helped break us out of prison. She was white, okay, you know, 'cause she died shortly after she got out. We raised over $15,000 for her, and she died within 2 weeks after she got out. If you listen to the leadership, in fact, writing the leadership in prison right now, they're happy to answer your letters. These are the ones who were in the struggle in the 60s and 70s, you know, and now they're coming, new people coming in out of 80s and 90s. There's the the animal rights people and the elf people. I mean, you know, these are people you can listen to. These people are trying to do things that the government won't do for them. Do, you know, won't step in, and it may be sloppy work. It looks like us, it's sloppy work, but they're doing everything they can to make themselves right. Yeah.
I have a quick question about, like, what your feeling is on reparations, because I was talking about the African People's Socialist Party. You said they were a nationalist group, but they're not.
They used to be, okay.
They have a Uhuru Solidarity Movement, mm-hmm. which is all white people who focus on reparations. So mm-hmm. I was just wondering mm-hmm. what your take is on reparations.
No, they're doing that work. They're doing right. I ain't got no complaints, and I'm, you know, more power to them, you know.
What's your view on that, though, like reparations to...
Of course, the Native Americans, they got, you know, I never marginalized Native Americans, you know. In fact, their sovereign reservations aren't as sovereign as they'd want them to be. They're still fighting. They're getting ripped off by the government, right. Or is not managing. The Japanese were interned for 2 years. My sister-in-law is Japanese. I've seen the money she got just for being locked up for those 2 years. Mm-hmm. Of course I believe in reparations. The Cubans, not the Cubans, but the Puerto Ricans need reparations for what's happening out there to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is not the United States, and a lot of people think it is. They're a dominated territory by the United States, abused too, in many ways. And they can't tell them to stop bombing our island, use them for bombing ranges, etc. They deserve reparations, you know. I do believe it, and it's a hard struggle, but if they're not going to give us reparations, we'll take what, you know, we want. We don't have to ask them for nothing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that woman in that Panther flick. And she said she got a shotgun in one hand and a baby in the other, and she's going to take what she wants.
Right.
Well, that's what we've got to think. This militant way of thinking, but we got to think that way.
So I'm from New York City, and there's a park in an area that I used to go to school in called Crispus Attucks Park. And it was under construction, but it was for a certain color of people because it's in Bed-Stuy and it's a heavily gentrified area. Mm-hmm. So it's like the part, I guess, that's on the black side is like it's just like disgusting. Nobody wants to go there. And there's the parts that has the monkey bars or whatever, the things that people actually wouldn't go to. And they started construction. There was a couple of $1 billion that was allocated to the reconstruction of the park, and it just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you go about getting people to realize that this is an issue? Because my mentor, he's trying to do that, and he's writing to different officials, and they're like, oh, we're gonna do it, and you don't see anything.
Well, I appreciate his good efforts and heart, but if I was there, I'd do a little armed propaganda. Mess that up until they start straightening up the other side. So they start living up to what they have to say. And it was effective in the old days. But as you know, if you're not at that level right now, I'm not going to put you at that level. And never tell anybody things they don't need to know. That's important. That's what Che taught us, even though he didn't pay too much attention. He got himself killed telling somebody that something they didn't need to know. I'll get you. Go ahead.
I was just really quick. I was wondering, you mentioned working with the Weather Underground, and you mentioned working with some white comrades.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I haven't really been comfortable and not sure that I really understand about the APSP so far, the group that I mentioned earlier, was their stance on the role of white people. It seems they're okay with working with white people, but they feel like we should stay, in our white communities, which I understand, and focus on only getting reparations, which again I understand, but what about people who are willing to take it to that next level? We don't need to be specific about what that is, but if people are willing to be working on a higher level or underground doing some more intense work, how would you feel about that?
When I'm working underground, who I work with, the people underground, it's their business. I'm not asking anybody to do more than that. Ed Mead worked with the Weather Underground to start off with. Then it became the John Brown Book Club. They weren't doing anything. So he went underground and decided, he had set up some kind of organization where they would do something and not ask anybody else to join in. We put out a newsletter called The Wild Turkey and to the public for opinions. And we could get responses back there, not directly to us, but we'd pick up responses. When I did the bomb inside the prison, there were 6 of us in the total prison. Only 6 of us knew what we were doing. But everybody agreed with what we were doing, agreed with what we were saying. What we were saying is something that appealed to them. When we threw out little hints about, if you care, grow hair, everybody did it because they agreed with us. Small group of people, they didn't know who it was. And we're not asking anybody, we definitely didn't want anybody else to come in on it because, you don't want everybody to know what you're doing because somebody's going to slip off and the man's going to undermine the whole project. That happened with all of the major militant radical groups in the 70s and 60s, that there were a lot of infiltration by the cops. If you're really going to be militant, keep it quiet. Trust no one and tell no one what they need to know, don't need to know. And like I say, that was something we learned from Che, and they were pretty successful. They outlived all of those presidents over in Cuba. The Cubans outlived all of our presidents to get what they wanted. They're at a situation right now where maybe they're going to have to yield a letter, but they still have a lot of support from Europe. If not from us, they got a lot of support from Europe to continue on. Yep. Oh, wait a minute. She wanted to.
I really enjoyed hearing at the beginning about all these different ideas that you came up with all these programs. That were I'd be happy if I had one of those ideas to come with. I see an endless stream of them, which is really amazing. And I'm wondering, Well, first I'm wondering if, so about an autobiography, if you have like anything in the works for telling your story or the story of all these programs.
You've been talking to Leslie there. Jalil been telling me to do that. A lot of people. Yeah. And, well, Jalil's idea, if you're not going to write a book, people have written so much about me in all these books, just clip them out, put them together, and say it's your book.
The other thing, like, I'm also wondering about the convention seems so good, and I just wonder about if that's happening in any
incarnation at this point, or if there's like, if you'd be interested, or I've never thought about like creating a blueprint for that could be spread around the country, and, you know, done independently. I'll think about it. go ahead and. We're going to get the other hands up because I want to try and get them in order. You, and then you. Okay, go ahead.
You were talking about, I always have the Socialist Party.
The African People's Socialist Party. Mm-hmm.
There's this guy on Tumblr there's this guy that I know. I pay a lot of attention to Tumblr. It's a great source of information. But I sat there and I was watching, and he put up a video. His name is Ghazi something.
Yeah.
And he put up this video, and I was with what was being said to a certain extent, but then it was like it was a colleague. The person was a comrade, basically, but he was letting Ghazi completely walk over him.
Oh,
like
Jesse.
Like, yeah, Jesse.
My homie Jesse.
Like,
it was funny.
When he told Jesse, like, when Jesse was trying to talk, he was just like, ah! And then Jesse would like be saying something very important and just shut up because Ghazi told him to. And it's just like, when does it become like, all right, that's a bit much. Like you matter. Like I understand you matter in that sense, because I just didn't under, like I wasn't with that. I wasn't with, the whole point is to uplift African Americans or uplift people of color. It said nothing about bringing down others. Mm-hmm. So when I saw that like display, I was just like, at first I understood like, oh, it's a joke. But then this person was like really, really doing whatever he said. And he has some pretty crazy and like radical ideas too. So I'm just like, when is it you're a comrade? And then when is it, oh, you know, this is problematic?
Like, I never criticize anybody in public. I'll wait till that closed meeting and talk to him. I was a lieutenant information, and the things that I said and things I taught, nobody ever questioned that until we had, you know, meetings separate from that about the leadership, what the leadership is supposed to do, divisions of labor, you know. And I just hung on to, of course, because I was one of the founders of the party, and nobody kicked me out. Between me and my partner, we flipped a coin saying who's going to be captain, who's going to be lieutenant information. That's where I got my assignment, the captain later. Well, that's another sad story, found hanging in a cell, so we don't know if you commit suicide or what. Okay, the second person was?
Regarding the subways, did you write that letter?
The subway incident?
Yeah, the incident on the subway. Did you write that letter?
I don't know what letter.
What's up?
I'm missing it.
When the two people got hurt, you said that there was a letter written.
Apologize.
Oh, no, and I shot a cop.
It was the Safeway.
Yeah.
Oh, the Safeway? No, I didn't write the letter.
Whoever did, that must have been nerve-wracking.
It's published. It's published in, oh gosh.
It's in the Movement with Teeth, right?
Yeah, Movement with Teeth up there, yeah. All of the communiques are published. Yeah, and now.
You said something where you said you were really more focused on domestic issues here within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, though, that what the United States is doing internationally contributes to our lives? Well, it does contribute to our lifestyles here, even though we do have a lot of issues going on within the country.
Definitely. All the money they're spending on that could be spent on domestic issues.
Right. Do you think if they were to not allocate so much money to defenses or going over and trying to like take over other countries, that they would actually institute like things here?
Well, the whole key is what you said, they, not us.
Yeah.
There's a closed group, that they is a closed group.
Yeah.
The people who fund Congress are the military industrialists. They make the weapons and all these the airplanes that don't fly, and get Congress to allocate money to buy those things that don't work, you know. So we don't have too much to say until we build up enough strength on a domestic level. I don't think we should move any further. I may be wrong, but I'm not the guru for you guys here. I'm just here to get a free meal, you know. Okay. Somebody else, I'll come back to you, but you got a lot of questions. But who else? Maybe you're going to be one of them, huh? Okay, go ahead. No, go ahead. You're up.
So this might be a little superficial, but okay, celebrities like, for example, I'm not sure if you heard about Stacey Dash, who was like, oh, she doesn't see why there should be like a Black History Month and BET is part of the problem. People that you can tell are obviously paid off by Fox. Like, how do you, those people, like, do you feel a sense of like disrespect or like, do you feel, when you hear these like ludicrous words coming out of people of color's mouth, do you ever feel any sort of way about it? Being that you, like, you're not like an average person, you're like, you've done stuff to like move people of color forward. Like, do you ever get upset when you hear this stuff?
Well, it's, yeah, I get upset, but let's get even. I mean, with the liberation schools, that's what we did. We didn't care what they thought, even if they might be Black, you know. Somebody gave them a professorship, so all of a sudden, you know, they can speak perfect English and stuff.
Yeah.
And don't say ain't or whatever. Yeah. They don't pay too much attention to those people. Okay, go ahead. But,
you know, it's interesting. I was thinking, you know, I'm the director of the Western New York Peace Center, and one of the things that I was thinking of offering to people here is about this anti-boycott and divestment and sanction. That in the state legislature here, they just passed something, the Senate, that just says that people can't do boycotts or trying to take money out or sanction to any allied country. Well, it's all about Israel, mm-hmm. is the one thing. And it's also like the thin end of the wedge. But this is about like working with, you know, on political stuff and organizing and votes and lobbying people and things like that. So when you were talking, I'm thinking, well, you know, it's all very much activism in the community, but yet the thing that you were just saying you're most interested, that you feel you was a great accomplishment, was about people should be able to vote. So in this broken system where, you know, money is ruling things and like that, if you would talk a little bit about what you think about like the political structure and the relationship to organizing.
Well, to start off, our political structure is fucked up. I mean, it's simple, yes, simple as that. And the point out, we never elected a president.
Right.
Electoral college does that. So that makes it totally fucked up. When they talk about other countries, you not being a fair election, nobody talks about ours never being a fair election. And it doesn't represent all the citizens. We talk about not only the 2.5 million people in prison, but there's, somebody said, 5 times that many who were in prison out and they still can't vote. That brings it up to almost 10 million people who can't vote. Our system is messed up. In order to change a lot of this stuff, we are going to have to break laws. And by talking about breaking laws, I mean, got to go farther than just marching in circles, mm-hmm. and going up to the town hall and listen to one of our spokesmen, a so-called spokesman, you know, a congressman or somebody on city council, or he'll get up and do his speech and everybody goes home. That's doing those marches is just one point. You got to do something beyond that. When it breaks up, break up with groups and say, hey, that's not enough. Super glue is good enough. If you really don't like the police department, super glue every lock they got on that building, you know. And just don't tell anybody who did it, you know. That's about it. Yeah.
What's your take on, like,
I'm not going to get out of this state now. You see that?
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're hearing Mark Cook speaking at Burning Books Bookstore in Buffalo, New York, February 18, 2016.
What's your take on Bernie Sanders and, like, because he said clearly in one of his statements that he's against reparations for them. So just wondering what your take is on him.
He's not educated. You know, education doesn't come all in a flash. I'm anthropologist, a cultural anthropologist, and I didn't learn it in school. Sure, I had one course in college in anthropology, but I went out on my own and discovered something that nobody teaches in any college. And if I publish anything, I'll publish that. I did have it copyrighted, so, but it's not published. There's things that aren't taught to us. Some of us have ideas that are beyond, you know, what is taught in school. I love math, but they locked me up for 40 years trying to keep me away from it, and I got every book I could get inside on math. I learned about things I don't even need to know about, you know. I'm really interested in this. There's two theories on gravity right now I'm really interested in. That ain't got nothing to do with what we're talking about here. But I'm just talking a bit about being educated. Educate yourself first. Bernie Sanders, no, we're not on the same page. I liked when he talked about being a socialist, a social democrat. I like that, but I don't think he is. I really don't think he is a social democrat. It's a good thing to get him in politics and the fight the Democrats, but because he's doing better now. I would flip a coin. I'd pick him before I'd pick Hillary. I'm sorry to say, yeah. And I may be wrong, but that's my opinion, and everybody's got it behind, you know.
From that show that I saw, I watched it three times, and I'd watch it every day if I could.
Yeah.
Because like I said, I was a kid and I was oblivious to what was going on in the world. And when they were talking anti-capitalist, I mean, they were talking for real.
Mm-hmm.
And that got the dander up of the capitalists, because now you're threatening their profit. Around 67, 68, I had heard, one of the kids I used to hang with had made this statement that the Black Panthers and the Hells Angels were going to battle it out. And later, my thumb's not on the pulse, but I had heard that came from a Vietnam vet who was released from Vietnam, and he thumbed across the country and caught a ride on the back of a motorcyclist. Maybe it was a Hell's Angel, and they were headed this way. And that may be somebody that I think I may know. That's why I said, but I don't have my thumb on the pulse. And then I read that in one of my books just recently, within the last couple of months. Was there any validity to that claim? That there was
going to
be a battle between the Hells Angels and the Black Panthers?
No, in fact, we some of our weapons were bought from the Hells Angels.
Ah.
Yeah, and here in I'm in the state of Washington. State of Washington, there was the bandits and the coyotes. You could buy weapons from them. When the brigade needed weapons, I gave them money. They went down all the way down to Arizona to get those weapons and bring them back. Hey, those years are gone. I mean, when I was in prison, the closest thing to a gang in prison when I was doing time were the bikers. That's the closest thing to a gang. There was no Black or Hispanic or white gangs in, and just they were the closest. They just ate at the same table, and one of their main rules was don't wash more than once a month, you know. So I'm serious. Those are some funky people. That's a that's closest thing to the gang. Things have changed. That's the time I lived in. Things have changed. My city has changed. People around and the movement has changed. We worked well with AIM and the Weather Underground and a lot of other liberal groups, not just radical groups, but liberal groups like the American Friends Service Committee, you know, that gave us a lot of funding, you know. But they were watched by COINTELPOL, just like all of the radical groups were. The Black churches were all watched, and that's all come out, you know, how the dirty tricks they did with Martin Luther King and such.
Do you think that was a tool, like segregating the prisons, also to, like divide the different groups as a way to for them not to band together and just like, you know, take over.
Oh, institutional racism is not a joke. When I happened to break it up in the prison I was in, but when I left, it came right back together. It was selling only of whites with whites, blacks with blacks, Indians with Indians in the state prison. We broke that up so people could live where they wanted to live. Of course, when I left, it slowly came back together, backed by the institution. In the federal institution, they have a ruling where there can be no groups living in one cell. No all blacks, no all whites, no all Indians, nothing. They make sure it's all split up. And I've sat with Aryan Brotherhoods in the same cell. You got no problem, and that's between the cell, there's no problem at all. And a lot of the biggest problems were between, like say, California blacks and D.C. blacks. Those are the problems they had to worry about. I came from Seattle, and they figured, because Seattle's in Washington, I belong to the D.C. side. You know, D.C., no matter how many times I tried to explain to them, it's two different cities. Yeah. And by some kind of genetic thing, a lot of those guys were short. People call them shorty, and I figured something was short up here, too. But anyway, yeah. Okay, you were first, and yeah, then you over here. Okay,
just
please.
Just say real quick, if anyone came in late, there's a basket up front. You can chip in, help make these things happen. And,
okay, thanks for coming, you guys.
Maybe we'll do one more question, and then Mark can talk on one-to-one basis.
Okay, first, my oldest brother was a cancer back in the 60s. So I was always fascinated by that. But I heard you say something about things change. I also was like this guy was talking about. I watched the documentary last night a couple times about the cancer movement. J. Edgar Hoover went to any length he can to disband the black cancer, but he did nothing for the Ku Klux Klan. Are they still going around? I mean, you said. The change. They still do. They America's oldest terrorist group.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But Hoover did nothing to disband them.
No. You're right. That's one of our biggest problems is they're used as soldiers for that controlling group. Yeah. Oh, yeah. One was the chief judge. Judge Black was that belonged to the Klan at one time. Yeah, we understand that. Everybody doesn't say who they are. You said to go back to. Oh, okay. Oh, on this one. Oh, one-on-one. You said that's what we're doing right now. I took a picture when I was a kid, before I first got locked up, and it's a strange picture. I had two babies in my hand, and both of them became Panthers. I was a Panther, and they're both my nephews, and they both became Panthers. Yeah. I look at it now, in all the time I had those pictures, I never realized. I'm trying to figure, did they catch something from me? Yeah, but that was kind of funny, but anyway.
Nature and nurture.
Thank you, Mark.